Welcome to Jax, and we're doing the Signals podcast live today for your entertainment. My name is Michael Doughton, and I'm pleased to be joined here today on the stage by Yuva Fredriksson and Sebastian Maya. And we're bringing back an apparently a very old Jax tradition that I have not been a part of, where these two have lengthy conversations here at the event. So, Sebastian, fill us in.
Yeah, just in the very moment where we were kind of thinking about how to do a few of the live podcasts here at the Jax conference, I referred to this old tradition, Uwe and myself sitting together and talking about, I don't know, the world, about IT. And I think it's always so inspiring. So I just thought, okay, why don't we do this in public? And to share this with all of you. And here we are. Thanks for joining, Uwe. And I also remember that Uwe said, what the heck are they want to talk with me? And then when I said, well, I just want to talk what we did every time, you said, okay, I'm in. That's the thing.
Yeah, that will be embarrassing, but anyway.
Just pretend it's the three of us, it'll be fine.
Uwe, maybe you introduce yourself quickly.
My name is Uwe Fredriksson, and I'm working in IT for about 45 years, meanwhile, or longer. And so as a professional IT person, doing that for a living, I'm doing that for about 35 years, meanwhile, lots of roles and blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. To make a long story short, at the moment, I'm working as CTO at a software consulting and development company called Codecentric. Should be enough for starters.
So as you said that you are already pretty long in the industry, I remember a friend of mine who is happens to be the founder of SNS Media, our company. He said, well, my idea was to miss the next big wave in IT. Then came GenAI and he said, oh, no, I need to get in again.
Yeah.
So there is this wave of IT. You've seen many of them over the years. Are you part of this wave?
Yeah, sure. I mean, part of my job, I have several roles at Codecentric, but the CTO role basically means that I have to look ahead a little bit. How could IT be in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? I mean, I'm also guessing, of course, but figuring out, so which kind of options do we have? What do we need to do now to make sure that we're not ending at a dead end in 2 or 5 years? And with that, it's obvious that I also have to dive into the whole GenAI, agentic coding, and so on movement. I mean, I have to understand it. Otherwise, it's very hard to make educated guesses, isn't it?
I think you have, or you're doing, or have been doing a session at this conference saying AI is a Brandbeschleuniger,
accelerator,
a catalyst, or how do you translate
catalyst,
this?
Yeah.
Catalyst. Just a catalyst, yeah.
Fire accelerant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Basically.
So, sure.
Okay. Okay. What do you mean by that?
Basically, it's not only me who's saying that. I also picked it up and it totally resonated with me. And I just read it again in the DORA report from last year. So this State of DevOps report, which then turned into the DORA report, which I think Google releases every year. And they looked at AI and how AI influences engineering organizations. And what they figured out, and what's also what I'm seeing a lot, is if you have crappy engineering practices, they amplify them. And if you have good engineering practices, they also amplify them. Mm-hmm. So it makes it a lot more visible what's going good or not so good in your organization. And it's important always for me to say, be careful, it's not only about the software development department, it's about the whole engineering that starts at management level, at business department level, goes to into operations and everything. So it's not limited to here, because the stories, the narratives that we hear at the moment is that AI is going to solve software development. Where I say, well, be careful because software development is so much driven from things outside of software development that I'm not sure if AI will simply solve that magically.
Right.
So we had this morning in the keynote, I tried to express a certain idea of enterprise AI. Then also Russ Miles added his view on AI, what it means to talk about AI literacy. So I got a feeling when I talked to many people that for many people it feels kind of contradictory when we say, hey, for doing AI, you must practice your engineering even harder, even more consequent. So things from the past, which are not considered to be the things of the future, must be done even better than in the past in order to handle the ultra new thing, which is AI. Would you agree with that? Because I feel like, okay, sometimes for people it's this kind of a mental, you know, contradiction or something like that.
It is a contradiction, actually. I mean, and the bigger contradiction is we have that narratives which the tech industry and the influencers and so on are telling us. So forget everything you ever done. AI is going to do that for you now. And then you have the people inside the community who tell you the opposite, basically, and say, no, you don't have to forget everything you've done. We are running, I mean, implicitly they're not saying it, but we are running on bleeding edge technology, which can give us great results, which can give us crappy results, depending on how you use it. And in order to get or to increase the likelihood of getting great results, you have to focus even more on your engineering practices or the good engineering practices you've learned before. For me, the hard part of this story is that you always get these contradictory stories and that you have believers over here and believers over here. I'm not going to judge who's right at that moment.
Yeah.
And this is more like a religious war than actually something like a well-grounded discussion which will give us a good consensus, but two parties beating at each other and nobody ever moving.
I feel like it's important for us in having these conversations to help people reframe the discussion because right now a lot of the discussion is, I don't know, Mac versus PC when we really want it to be one where we're constructively trying to help iterate on what is a solution? What is a good way of thinking about things?
Oh, that question is so good that I have to think about it for a second. Let me try to start from a different angle. I'm also working with customers who say, yeah, we want to introduce AI into our engineering departments because we want to speed them up, more throughput and so on. And and first thing I ask them is, okay, what's your goal? More throughput. Why more throughput? And don't you really want to have more value, business value? I mean, if you just build crap faster, that doesn't make any difference at the market or even annoys your customers, what's the point of that? Most often, I get them thinking at that moment. I'm not always successful, but more often than not, I'm successful. Like, okay, let's figure out what's your goal. Okay, I want to become better at creating business value or outcome or impact or however you want to frame that. I mean, the product development community talks a lot about outcome and impact, and that's actually what we want to achieve.
Sure.
So, and say, okay, let's take that as a North Star. How are we getting there? We have to convince our product managers. The problem is we have a long-standing tradition in companies that let's blame the developers because they're too slow, they're too expensive, and so on, yada, yada, yada. And therefore, it's their fault that we are not making tons more of money. And it's not. The problem is that about 60 to 90% of all requirements we're implementing do not create any business value. They are just sitting, lurking in the systems, making them more complicated, building basically business debt. Not technical debt, but business debt, which is even worse than technical debt because you cannot that easily identify it as a developer.
Right.
And because it's in there and everybody tells you we need to have that, while we're not needing to have that in there. And so we're sitting there and we're trying to convince that product manager to work more with hypotheses, so with measuring actually the outcome, the impact, measuring if the users are picking up these ideas, how to respond to that, that we're not building big epics with $1 million put on that or euros while we're here in Europe, but basically the same story, but that we split them up into a series of smaller questions and iterate over them and so on. The problem is they won't listen to say, hey, you're crappy, become faster. And so I say, let's start with doing our homework, automating the things and becoming better in releasing stuff, the automated tested and all the things.
Quick question. When you're saying doing our homework, you mean engineering?
Engineering, software engineering,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because we're talking about the whole organization.
Yeah,
one,
right. And
but you're saying now our is engineering. Now,
yes, it's software engineering. Yeah. So that... Let's take a simple benchmark that if you get a small requirement that you're able to implement and release that within the same day on demand. So you don't always have to release several times a day, but you must be able confidentially mm-hmm. to do that. Yep. And then the second thing we have to build in is observability, which does not stop at the application level but moves up to the business level, saying, okay, we are going to measure how often features are used, how much more revenue goes through the system, and all these metrics. And then we're able to do that. We have the metrics, and then we can have a silent conversation with our product manager and say, here, coffee one-on-one, I can make you hero or the opposite.
Yeah.
And here are the numbers. Here are the last 50 requirements that we implemented for you. And here is how much they picked up, so how much they resonated with your customers. And we can help you. We will also assist you. We have everything in place to become the hero, to boost your impact in the company, to become the best product manager of the company. Mm-hmm. And or we can share these numbers with everyone. So, okay, only using the last part of the sentence if we really have to. But so creating a win-win situation for the product manager. And then and here comes AI into the play, because AI can help us with parts of the automation. It can help us to free the mind of the product managers, going back from always doing this, how Constantine yesterday called that transactional work.
Yep.
So making, writing down stuff or analyzing some user surveys and so on and blah, blah, blah. And say, really having, okay, how can I phrase these ideas that I have in ways that we create a series of hypotheses, and what do I want to measure with that to figure out if we're on the right track? And then I can also use AI, and because now producing code becomes unbelievably cheap in some way. I mean, let's not discuss quality in exploration. Exploration is a different story than expansion or extraction, basically, if we take the 3X model from Kent Beck. We can very quickly iterate and release code to figure out, are we on the right track? Are we on the right track? Of course, we have to pay the debt later on and rework that, but even there, AI can have it. But we have a completely different conversation now, how we can introduce AI, how we can use it, how we can use it to leverage the business value and so on, and not just, oh, developers are too slow, let's make them faster.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the important things that you said is the concept that you can have a metric and not necessarily always feel like you have to maximize it.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about it's important that we be able to release multiple times a day. It is not necessarily important that we do so. And yet I've seen organizations, hey, it's important that we release two or three times a day, every single day. And if you're not doing that, you're failing as a development organization, right? And so how do you recommend that we take some of these metrics, we take the enablements we get out of AI and avoid the pitfall of assuming that we must do this in this like high velocity?
It's I remember some other colleague here from the community who once said, metrics are crucial and they're also our worst enemies, basically. Because the key point is basically we want to achieve some kind of quality.
Yeah.
But quality is not quantity.
Right.
So quality is something in the eye of beholder, subjective, and basically, I think per definition, not measurable in itself. So what we have to do is we have to create some kind of proxy metrics, which gives us an indication if we're on the right track. They're very helpful. The problem with these proxy metrics then is that we figure out or that they become an end in itself over time. So we optimize for the metric, for deployments per day or something like that,
right.
If you take the DORA metrics. And I would say, look at your context. I mean, if I, in a highly uncertain environment, extremely maybe in a winner-takes-all environment, where only if I'm the fastest to lead the innovation, the development of this domain, that I will be the sole survivor in there, then it's extremely important that I ask as many questions as possible at the customers to get some kind of feedback from them. If I'm in a highly mature market where maybe cost efficiency is more important than releasing several times a day, I don't really need to do that. So always take the context where you're living in, what you're working in, into account, and then make a sane decision. At least that's what my typical recommendation is.
Okay. You were just touching a topic. I remember we were discussing something similar last year or 2 years ago. We were talking about the so-called software crisis. You were touching this. So engineering has always been blamed for, we could have had much better performance. We could have made much more money if only software engineering would be a bit faster. So bottleneck clearly on the software engineering side being said. You were just saying, hey, finally we managed the software crisis. This was kind of pre-Gen-AI, in the sense of, hey, with Agile, with lots of ideas in the sense of automation, probably with lots of ideas which are coming from also the DevOps world, and this whole bundle of things which we developed, which are partly pure tech and infrastructure, but also partly, let's say, mindset, people, culture, process, communication, these kind of things, right? So with this bundle of measures, we came to a level where one could say, or I remember your words, we are kind of on the level now. And that's how I understood your words.
Okay.
And now with Gen-AI, what happens now?
I think Gen-AI doesn't change the story. I mean, we know how we could be on top of that demand crisis. And there are some companies out there that are. But the average company is not there. I mean, big part of it is that they're still efficiency obsessed and haven't understood software. I mean, as long as I'm still going to confuse software with a physical product, like building a car or a house, I'm trying to optimize the production cost.
Yeah.
The problem of software is, which Maya Lehman already said in 1980, so it's only 45 years ago, or 46 meanwhile. we already have forgotten that at least 10 times in IT, but let's assume we still know that. That software always needs to be changed to preserve its value. And so it's a different story. I mean, if I am a young lad and full of testosterone and try to show off, I build a nice sports car. Maybe I find, find a nice girl, marry her, and then we start a family, and I will sell my race car and the bulkheads. Thanks a lot. The word was just gone. Thanks a lot. And so the children, he's still attached to the bulkheads in the ship and something like that. I mean, that's what we're doing in software every day. And therefore, production costs is 10% of the whole story. But the people not understanding software are going there, only fixated on production costs, and then trying to minimize production costs by all means, because they still take effectiveness, which is very different from efficiency, because effectiveness is doing the right thing. So doing what creates value, impact, outcome, you name it. And efficiency is doing something defined, not knowing what the value of that is, at least cost. Yeah. And which is a completely different story. Both have a value, so you have to look at both of them, but most companies only look at one of them. And then, the result is suboptimal decisions from management, from business departments, and so on, and resulting in that we still haven't solved the software crisis, but not because we couldn't do it, but because we're not let.
How many companies hang on to sunk cost fallacy, where they've invested in an approach... And like you say, they've invested in the sports car, so they're going to turn that sports car into an airplane because they've already invested in it, when it's clearly not the rational thing to do.
Okay, sunk cost fallacy is strong in us. That's absolutely it. Gives us another rabbit hole. Not sure if I really want to dive into that one.
Fair.
but you're absolutely right. So sunk cost fallacy is strong. So we have invested that much money, so we still have to double down on this approach and all these things.
But that same thing happens not just with products we've built and things we've created. And in our products, but it also happens sometimes in our approach and our mentality. Mm-hmm. We've started down a road. Mm-hmm. How do you get organizations to stop? You mentioned we could fix this. Mm-hmm. How do you get organizations to stop in their tracks and say, okay, I'm going to stop doing things this wrong way and think about how to fix it, whether we're using new tools to do that or even old ones?
Full disclaimer, I'm a terrible change agent. I don't have the patience to deal with persons who come the 10th time and say, yes, but. And Germans are perfect in saying, yes, but. We are the development of from the Homo sapiens into the Homo yes, but. As Germans, in a nutshell, usually. I'm terrible. I still try to, the only thing I always say, the only thing I am able to do is say, here's a wall which you're going to hit, and you feel that you're hitting a wall. I show you a door. I tell you what's behind that door. I also explain to you why it makes sense to go through that door. So I'm trying to create a picture, an image, what we could achieve, what could be first steps, and so on. But I also say very clearly to the people, I give a ... if you go through that door. That's your decision in the end. And if I'm not going to push you through that, if you are standing like that before the door and trying to resist to go through that door, that's, again, your decision. The next problem we're having in organizations is that it's not only people, it's the organization. The organization is a higher level system which basically has its own mind, its own memory. It's called company culture, basically. It's the things that happen between the people, how they interact, and which patterns had been successful in the past, which patterns has not been successful in the past, where you've been punished for as an organization or not, and all these things shape how it responds, and it's even harder to change this thing. Yeah. So basically, from the way... My personal approach is saying, okay, we try to get there, what is the reasonable idea, and then what would be reasonable first steps. And usually they're not so much tool fixated or something like that. I mean, if we're talking about technical tools. So I don't think that Jira will solve an agile introduction. Fool with a tool is still a fool. There are some wisdom in that saying.
Right.
Another topic I wanted to talk to you is an observation I made, and I'm happy if you can comment on this. Talking again about GenAI in the, mm-hmm. in the software engineering world, we know there are, let's say, at least two different angles. One is GenAI being a part of the software engineering process, and the other thing is GenAI being part of the product, yeah, being mm-hmm. a feature of something, mm-hmm. which does something for mm-hmm. the customer, for the end user. And what one can learn over time is, of course, in the end, now we got the thing more or less. Yeah, what mm-hmm. does this GenAI thing doing is doing what our LLMs are doing, and we finally need to look at what we humans are doing mm-hmm. in, with respect to this mm-hmm. new quality of an agent which does something mm-hmm. in our system. And when we look at on us humans, especially in, let's say, in the software creation process, then we got a party which is traditionally, who are the experts in talking about exactly that? It's the agile folks. Mm-hmm. So I'm really convinced that agile really changed the game pretty deeply. Mm-hmm. Although we say, we got a lot of, this cargo cult. Yeah, so mm-hmm. kind of we just imitate agile rituals and we're not really doing mm-hmm. it. But in the end, I think we both would agree that those principles, those values, those habits, those experience continue to be mm-hmm. valid, more or less. My question now is, I would expect the agile community to be at the forefront mm-hmm. to talk to us about how to deal with this thing called mm-hmm. GenAI. Mm-hmm. But, and I don't know if Wolfgang is here, we also had this conversation.
He was here.
He used to be here. I said, why the hell? I expect you agile people to be the expert to lead that conversations mm-hmm. because you were leading yeah. this conversation about what it means to be a human being mm-hmm. in this production environment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why don't we see them? Or is it only me who does not see them?
Okay. My personal take on that one. First of all, I doubt that we really have understood what LLMs are because mm-hmm. we are still confusing them way too much with humans. And mm-hmm. LLMs may have some kind of intelligence. I'm not an expert in rating intelligence of people or things. There are people out there who are much better than I am in that. But if they have some kind of intelligence, it's very different from human intelligence. Also, the behavior yeah. is different. So even if they, I don't mean that pejoratively, but if they imitate how to speak like humans, I mean, that's a great thing that they move the human-machine interface more towards how humans interact than that we have to interact with machines more on the machine level and can interact with the machines more on a human-like level, like we interact with each other. That's a great thing, basically. But I still think we haven't figured that out. About the agile community, does it still exist? I mean, let's be a little bit mean. Agile had its time as a term, basically. And most agile transitions failed, basically, in terms that if you go to organizations, they move for a while to Scrum and doing all these cargo calls, and then they finally say, hey, great, they're safe. We can go back to what we had before because safe allows us to do whatever we did before, but we have these fancy new names for the roles, yeah. basically. But we still have this... levels of indirection between someone's had an idea until yeah. it comes down to the developers, which are nicely in a safe diagram, put down left in the corner. So, yeah, let's put them back into the cellar. This developers are new to kingmakers. Let's get rid of that fat and so on. And basically, the mindset is still alive, but the people moved into different directions. They moved into product development, yeah. they moved into DevOps, they moved into other ideas and so on. So we still have that. And if we go back into the original idea, I mean, for me, agility is inspect and adapt, mm-hmm. period. That's it. I mean, agility is this rediscovery of, if we have some level of uncertainty which we have to deal with. If we have some level of complexity out there that we cannot perfectly predict, maybe it's a good idea not to have a big plan and run through that and then be surprised that the result does not fit to the reality anymore, but that we can go there stepwise and have opportunities to adjust. I mean, that's basically agility in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And everything else is ceremony or ideas, how to implement that and so on. And I think this idea is still alive, but it's there are nobody out there or very few people out there who say, we are agile advocates. I mean, you don't make a living anymore. Everybody's agile. Yeah. Every company is agile. I mean, they're not agile, but they, of course they're agile. You can go to the next bus stop and ask the people, are you agile? Of course I'm agile. And so it's over, basically. The term is over.
Yeah.
Not the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's just my guess. That's maybe one of the reasons why you don't hear a lot from some agile community anymore about this idea of Gen AI and how to adopt the ideas of Gen AI to use that to speed up product development. You even hear a lot more from the product community. I mean, you're deeply involved in that one.
So one of the things that I unfortunately do see or have been seeing for years with agile rollouts at organizations is that their misguided implementation of Agile often drives exactly what you referred to earlier in our conversation about how we're building the wrong requirements, and that's a big part of why the software teams are failing. And so organizations, and you've seen memes and jokes about this for years, but Agile doesn't just mean build more things faster with less resources. And a lot of organizations were using Agile to put the burden on developers for what it means to design and build a product. They're skipping design phases. They're just skipping UX research. They're skipping all kinds of steps and just trying to put more and more burden on the developer as part of the life cycle of building a product. And that doesn't work. We know that doesn't work, and you alluded to that earlier. How do we avoid that same pitfall with the next mentality model that's going to be developing around what it means culturally to be a software development team, to be a product development team, and to incorporate AI into whatever the next thing is? Because I think that you mentioned the language shift. We're speaking more at a human level now than a machine level. The downside of that is it makes it easier for us to make mistakes by assuming, when we talk to another human, we assume that they are going to understand context and provide their own intelligence behind things and catch us in mistakes. And if that's not happening behind the scenes, we're opening ourselves up to maybe reproducing the same types of mistakes we made with Agile. Do you see a kind of a path forward for this, or have a recommendation on how we navigate this whole paradigm shift?
Give me a few billion dollars to influence the market and maybe I'm in the position to do it. I mean, the short and harsh answer is we won't. It will happen, period. The point is, what we see, and we haven't seen that in this extreme form before. I mean, we always seen that investors have put quite large bets on technology. It was a quite lucrative business, basically, to bet on technology. What more usually a safe bet, especially when the interest rates were low, it was a good idea to bet on technology. And therefore, we had all these golden years between, say, 2008 and so into 2023, basically. But what we see for the first time is that basically all companies and all venture capitalists have put all their bets on a single topic. And they're all in some way desperate to win that bet.
Yeah.
they're absolutely desperate to win that bet, to keep their
because the winner will take it all, as you just said.
Yeah, it's a winner-take-it-all game. It's just a few parties who will survive that game, and they may cash big or not. I mean, if we would have some kind of what Simon Willison calls the challenger moment of AI, so that we have this huge failure, which would turn into a big disappointment of AI, that would still stay something, but maybe everybody would lose of them. So like the people who bet on blockchain too much and so on. But and therefore, and their narratives are shaped around use it, don't think, use it. It will solve all your problems. And they're using tons of money, billions and billions of dollars to send this message. I mean, if a Dario Amodei is out there and says with some fake tears, oh, I'm so concerned that AI may take away a lot of white-collar jobs. I mean, basically, this message he sent out is, hey, investors, listen, we have some opportunity for investment for you. We are going, so we are having the, how's that called again, this... going live on a stock exchange.
Oh, yeah,
the
IPO.
IPO, right, thanks. We are doing IPO next year. Do not forget to invest in us, right, and let's get the as highest valuation as possible. It's okay that Dario is saying that because it's his job saying that. The problem is that he influences a lot of people who make decisions with that. And then we still have the Gen AI thing, and then Clark's third law really strikes. Any far advanced technology or advanced technology that is advanced far enough is indistinguishable from magic. And for most people in the world, Gen AI is magic. They have no clue how it's working. That's more than 99.99% of the humanity who have no clue. And then we have this a few people have some idea about that, and then you have very, very few people who really understand how it does, how it works. And therefore, I'm afraid, so we will go down the road. The only thing that I think that you and I and you can do is that we try in our very tiny bubble of influence the idea, say, hey, the good old practices of software development are still valid. Yeah. It's still about creating value for customers. Let's figure out how to do that. It's still about automation still has a value. Let's figure out to do that in reliable. And also let's figure out two things, or let's distinguish two things. Software and Gen AI are different tools. They have different characteristics. This one, software, is deterministic, and sometimes it's a little bit stupid. So if we ask software to do something which is not in its code, it gives us reliably very stupid answers if it doesn't crash. This Gen AI technology is very different. It's it doesn't crash. It always gives you an answer. It surprisingly often gives us good answers, but it's non-deterministic. So there are chances that it goes wrong, and it can also go terribly wrong in its suggestions. They're getting better, but there's still this probability in here. But now let's go back to the problems that we're trying to solve. There are problems out there where it's perfectly fine if we're going wrong once in a time, but therefore providing answers all the time, even if they're wrong sometimes. And in some other situations, like maybe depositing money or withdrawing money, and so I don't want to have some probability if you go to the teller that I get some money or not. I want to get the money, and if there's money on my bank account, I want to make sure that I get money from the bank from the teller. So maybe the teller machine may be a little bit stupid if I ask it something outside of depositing or withdrawing money, and that's perfectly fine for me. But as long as it completely deterministically and reliably does its job, and so maybe that's the new thing. We have a new tool to work with, and that's fascinating, actually.
I absolutely agree with everything you said. My concern is that the teller example, the bank example, isn't actually a good one.
Okay.
And here's why. Because I feel like a lot of folks, for the same reason you alluded to earlier, where they don't necessarily understand how the technology works, they might think, wow, it's okay if it's not perfect because I want to get more money than I actually have when I go to the cash machine, right? Because we live in a world where sometimes the business value decisions are driven by specifically the people that don't necessarily understand the inner workings of the technology, what kind of responsibility do we have as engineers who do understand this to kind of provide guardrails against that sort of mistaken understanding?
I think we all, starting with people who call themselves architects, but also over everyone who calls themselves engineer, we should make the trade-offs clear. So if, I mean, it's still the old trade-off thing. I mean, architectural work in a nutshell. So figuring out which options do we have, making clear the trade-offs and help the people to make the best decisions possible. I mean, that's basically what I call architectural work in a nutshell. Right. And this, I think we have this responsibility, and when... very often when I work with customers, no matter if it's a strategic or a technical assignment or anything like that, in the end, I'm always doing the same thing. I'm showing options and the trade-offs and help the people understand what these trade-offs are to enable them to make good decisions. I mean, it's about enablement. We cannot force people into making the right decisions, at least as we are service suppliers in some way, if we are not the decision makers. And very often we are not the decision maker. But we can help people making best decisions possible. And it's not that people making subpar decisions or even bad decisions because they're evil people. A few of them are, but most of them are not. But because they didn't have all the information that they needed to have in order to make the best possible decision. Yes. And therefore, I absolutely agree with you and say, we have this responsibility to share this understanding that we might have that other people might not have. Again, we cannot expect everyone to do what we recommend them to do. Mm-hmm. But at least we did our share to help them to know what it means, making a decision, which options they have, what their ups and downsides are, and then in the end, at least I, as a consultant, have then say, okay, from now on, it's your job.
That's one of the things I love about consulting, and I think it's an advantage that we have being in that position, that when we're meeting with a business or a client or a decision maker, we can present them the facts and allow them to choose. And at that point in time, we can choose if we're going to proceed working with them or not, potentially. There's options that we have, and we're almost expected to challenge them, to ask them good questions, to try to inform them on things. They expect that from us as a consultant. Do you have any advice for somebody that is in an enterprise situation where there may be more of a, here's the thing to do, go do it type of role, and that's maybe a little bit harder, but they still kind of want to make these differences.
Ask your people. They know the answers, and listen to them. Very often I came to companies, and I talked, and some decision makers said, yeah, we have to solve this problem X, Y, or Z, or something like that, and we have no idea how to do it. I asked... talked to a few people in there, and they exactly knew how to solve it. Mm-hmm. They always know how to solve it. You only have to listen. And so usually, very often, my job was simply to write down whatever people knew, bring that knowledge together and share the result. And I was like, wow, you must be brilliant to come up with that. Sorry, folks, I'm not brilliant. I just wrote down what you told me and put it into a consistent form. So this distributed knowledge which is in there. Maybe we need more people in companies, but this division of labor idea that's still in the minds of many people makes that hard for them, which brings together this scattered knowledge and brings that into a consistent form, something like that. So this advisory to the CTO or anything like that, the person who listens to the other people, who brings this together and talks with the people and so on, and saying that, okay, here, we know everything. We don't need to hire Uwe for that. We can do that ourselves. I mean, bad for my business, but good for companies.
Right.
After having listening to you, now I'm going to create an agent called Uwe, which behaves exactly like you, which does that kind of listening and synthesizing and then giving feedback in the same way as you just described here.
Only if you can design that agent to be barefoot.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not Uwe.
No, but the reason why I'm asking this question, why we're making this joke, so then again, still, what is the difference? You just described this. Hey, I'm just here. I'm just listening. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm just kind of mirroring what you guys are doing anyway, which I totally get. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then maybe AI does the same thing. So mm-hmm. what is the little extra you are bringing in as a so-called human being?
A different kind of context, probably. Mm-hmm. So having seen a lot of things, I'm not always wrong. I'm also not always wrong. But having seen a lot of things in the industry about many different domains gives me a good intuition, whatever that means, to say, okay, here's an important bit of information, here's a not so important bit of information. And I think that good consultants are often that way, no matter if they're inside the company or outside the company. Mm-hmm. So I think that's this individual advantage that I as a person could offer. What I see quite often in companies is that they put together some information, but that they have a hard time to distinguish chaff from wheat, basically. So what's the important bits and what's not? Maybe the difference that I can sometimes make is that I say, okay, here are the important things of all the information that I gathered from you, and here are the things that you can ignore at the moment, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think that this kind of understanding, and also importantly, understanding organizations, software, everything is about humans in the end, even if people are trying hard to pretend that it's not. It's about humans. Yeah. And LLMs do not understand humans. Because, again, they may be smart in some way, but they're not human, and they cannot understand humans. They can be very, very useful, but understanding human needs and demands and desires and emotions and so on, most likely you still need a human for that one. At least that's my personal guess, unless we see something very different from the AI sector, but this will not be LLMs.
You could give, of course, a lot of context again about what does product quality mean for me? What does good user experience mean for me? You could give lots of theories, right, about that kind of context, but still it's you to decide to listen on which theory, for example.
Absolutely. And, I mean, they're great for research, for instance, saying, okay, let's bring all that information together. I mean, sometimes you have to cross-check that they brought the right information together then, but still great tooling for that. But for decision-making, I think, it's not that humans always make great decisions. We know a lot of counterexamples about that one. But still, I think that for these kind of decisions, it makes a lot of sense still to have humans in there that make these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Just to wrap it up a little bit from my side. So one thing is also always in my mind, because we were discussing internally, maybe a good kind of slogan, yeah, for what it could mean being an engineer in this AI-driven world, could be something like maximize value for your customer, whatever, by using the least numbers of tokens.
Actually, I don't want to care about tokens. I mean, the environment
cares for tokens, and somebody has to pay for them.
The point is, as long as we need to take care about tokens, basically, we have a problem with that technology in some way, mm-hmm. because we limit the access to it. So the whole narrative breaks apart that the tech companies are trying to sell, go all in with AI and use it as much as possible and so on. If, on the other hand, they're forcing us into a kind of usage behavior that says, but it's so inhibitory expensive that, you can't use it as you want to. So yeah. Do not, basically, with the pricing, then they would tell the story, don't go all in. So, and that's the point where I'm saying, okay, if I really have to think about how to leverage AI the best way, if possible, I do not want to think about tokens. And from the experiments that we made, with open weight models for software development, I mean, you have to put a little bit more effort into harness engineering for that one. But basically, I have a colleague who says, I don't see a difference anymore between Sonnet 4.6 or Kimi K 2.6 or something like that. It's the same for me. I even cannot recognize the differences in the results I get. And I do not care about the number of tokens from these models, basically. I mean, I built a little prototype with both models, and with Sonnet, it cost about, I have the numbers which I can see there. With Sonnet, it cost me about 40K. 40 euros. 40K would have been a little bit much for a showcase. And probably my CEO would have come after me for that one. But anyway, so 40 euros. And with Kimi, it cost me exactly the same thing. No harness engineering, no nothing, but quite almost as results being almost as good as with Sonnet 4.6, it cost me about $1. Mm-hmm. So there's some leverage in there that we can still figure out and still probably the colleagues from T-Mobile or Telecom would tell us then, hey, we are also building some kind of hardware and computing centers where you can run locally all these nice models. And then we can use their offerings, or from other companies. There are a lot of companies like Inceptron in Sweden, like Nebius in Netherlands, and also OVH in France, and also the German companies and so on, where we can run all these open weight models, basically. So coming back to your claim, it didn't change. We want to create business value. And we still want to do that we also want to have an eye on efficiency, because, again, effectiveness without efficiency means that you may pay more money for creating the stuff than you may earn for it, because effectiveness does not care about how much it costs. It only it cares about value. Therefore, efficiency has a value. Maybe the slogan is, we're able to balance those two things in the best way.
Last question from my side. As we said in the beginning, this goes back to our series of conversations. Mm-hmm. Talking to you as somebody, as you just said, who is part of this community mm-hmm. for so many years, mm-hmm. looking from now to the future? Is there something where you're kind of personally looking forward, where you're saying, this is exciting? Because maybe we are all stupid and looking just for Gen AI, and you're telling us, no, there's, I don't know, something happening, or maybe a precious thing we should know about, yeah, in the industry.
It's still early research, but what I find much more interesting at the moment, if I look at the AI developments than generative AI, are the world models like Jan LeCun currently is building with the YEPA approaches. But it's still quite early. I mean, he got one of the biggest fundings, I'm not sure, seed or A-series fundings that ever was anybody got in Europe. He went from Meta to Europe and to France, actually. I mean, he's French-speaking, so that's an obvious choice for him. There's a lot of interesting things happening outside this, saying, okay, with symbolic AI, I mean, when the people examined Claude Code after the code leaked, they figured out, oh, internally, it has built in a lot of symbolic AI approaches to basically put on top of the generative AI approaches in order to balance the oddities that you get from generative AI in some way. It's still not perfect in there. I mean, we experience that every day if we work with Claude Code. It's interesting to see these kind of movements. I think that's very interesting to see, and I'm curious to see if we eventually understand this importance of resilience to deal with all the uncertainty which we face at several levels, at the market level, at the geo-economical and geopolitical levels, but in all these other levels, also at the personal levels, then if we figure out how to balance this sustainability thing, not necessarily only with in terms of ecologic sustainability, but also in economic sustainability, so not only looking at the here and now, but at the future well-being in companies, which is much better in companies which never went IPO, which never went to the stock exchange, never did the IPO. But anyway, and also how to deal with this exploding complexity and so on, if we eventually will learn that. But it's more like a thing of curiosity if that will be islands or if this will be spread out of necessity, basically.
Great. Oh. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Uwe and Sebastian, for being here today. It was fantastic to talk with you. Thank you all for being here today at JAX, either live or online. And I'm sure you will find this entire conversation and probably excerpts available on DevMio and Vikla in the near future. So
okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.